University Forum is a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University, which brings speakers and performers to the campus throughout the semester to lecture on a variety of topics. The opinions expressed by the speakers do not necessarily represent the opinions of Nebraska Wesleyan University or of this station. Today, University Forum presents Dr. Robert Lisensky, president of a Boulder, Colorado firm which provides consulting and instructional services to colleges and universities. His topic is liberal education, reform, or renewal. He previously served for 7 years as president of Willamette University in Salem, Oregon, and 2 years as executive vice president of the Council of Independent Colleges in Washington, D.C.
Good morning. Welcome to the first forum of the spring semester and the last in a series of lectureships celebrating our centennial this week. On Tuesday, we gave a look to the past and our heritage. On Wednesday, we gave a look to our present. Today, we give a look to our future. Our speaker this morning is Robert Paul Lisensky. If you open to page 3 of the handout, part of his vita is there. The first thing that you will notice is that he is president of NCHEMS Management Services, which means National Center for Higher Education Management Systems Management Services, Inc. That means if you could remember what the acronym meant, you could get the job. I had a Andy Rooney sort of thought this morning about academia when we award honorary degrees. We write a nice vita for the honoree, and then we gather all the students that we've had for 4 years and ourselves with advanced degrees, and in front of witnesses, parents, friends, supporters, we read to them what's already in their program. What does that say about our confidence as educators and the educational task? Rather than rehearse what you can read for yourself, let me just highlight a couple of research areas that Professor Lisensky has been involved in. One paper is entitled Value-Centered Education. Another, The Family and the Deaf Child. Another, and we have all ordered this for all members of the faculty, Presidential Evaluation and Development. Most recently, Professor Lisensky has been involved in a research project which culminated in a volume entitled The New Liberal Learning, Technology, and the Liberal Arts. There is one paragraph from the published form of that research which I would like to lift up. In the preface, the editor writes, "It is precisely because of the need for educators to rethink and refocus the traditional liberal arts curriculum that the authors call for a new liberal learning, a liberal arts curriculum that includes the study of technology as a mode of inquiry equal to the traditional methods used in science and the humanities. Indeed, as Robert Lisensky observes, technology may well be the key link between these traditionally divergent disciplines. Providing the how-to, technology can bridge the gap between the scientist's observation of what is and the humanist's vision of what ought to be." Those of you who are present for the faculty seminar with the president know that a question about what is the university's role in what ought to be was raised in that forum. And I hope it will be a question that we will pursue with our guest today. Help me welcome to our campus Robert Paul Lisensky.
I am grateful for the invitation to share with you in the celebration of this important moment in the history of this institution. And I'm also pleased to be able to accept the invitation of your president. We have been friends for a number of years, and I respect him as a person and as an educator and as a leader. I must admit that I don't know a great deal about Nebraska Wesleyan, except what I have read in the catalog, the long-range planning report, and the various databases that we can get our hands on, and a few conversations. But I expect that the reason that I was invited to participate was because of the opportunities I've had over the years to be an observer of the higher education scene, as a faculty member, as an academic dean, as a university president, as a professional staff member in a national association, and finally, as a consultant. And when I think about the years that I have spent in higher education, and then the tremendous shifts that have taken place, I am shocked. When I began my career in higher education, it was known as the golden years. Enrollments were on a constant rise. Everyone, especially government officials, saw education as a national treasure. Revenues more than met expenditures. And long-range planning was engagement in developing new programs to use the ever-increasing resources. And now, just about everything is in reverse. I also remember how our humor has changed. We once were able to laugh at ourselves. One of the first stories I heard at a National Association meeting in my early years in higher education was a good news, bad news story. And the Dean of Student Affairs is calling up the father of one of the young men in that institution. And the dean said to the father, "I have some good news and I have some bad news." And the father said, "Well, maybe you better give me the bad news first." And the dean said, "Well, the bad news is that your son is running around with a very unsavory crowd. He is missing all of his classes, failing all of his courses, and he broke every rule that we have created in the dormitories." And the father said, "Well, then maybe you better give me the good news." "The good news? He's just been elected homecoming queen." Now, from that story, we come to the stories that we have now. And that is the story about two men who go to Colorado on the basis that they're going to climb a mountain. And their host tells them the night before that there have been a number of bears that have been sighted and that they had the need to be very careful. And so the next morning they're getting ready, and the one fellow looks at the other and he says, "What are you doing putting on running shoes?" And the other fellow said, "Because of the bears." And the man said, "But you can't outrun a bear." He said, "I don't have to outrun the bear." And so we find words like comparative and competitive advantage. And what we think we need to do is to have our institution just be a little bit ahead of the other institution. But let's really get at our task. And before we do, I'm tempted to talk about the wonderful prayer, which is called the Educator's Prayer. "O Lord, spare me from intellectual arrogance," by which I mean the following. For the past week, you have been engaged in celebrating 100 years of excellence in liberal education. And it is a wonderful time to celebrate and to review past achievements, to remember those whose lives provide the strength of this institution and its history, and to rededicate the university to the future. And I leave the necessary and enjoyable assignment of reminiscing to those who are much more knowledgeable about the institution. But my task is to try to use history in such a way as to help enhance the future. In thinking about the period between January 20, 1887, and now, the first question that comes to mind is, what has made the university successful? And it is highly probable that Nebraska Wesleyan has been a successful institution because she has provided an educational experience distinctive in milieu, program, and impact. She has been distinctive in form and pedagogy from the larger state universities. Like all church-related college, she has been a founder and a defender of the liberal arts. She has sought to educate the whole person, to maintain a balance between teaching the subject and teaching the student. And she made provision for the religious dimensions in curriculum and extracurricular programs. Nebraska Wesleyan has had a distinctive identity and purpose. If she was a typical church-related college, she had an underlying system of beliefs which had impelled individuals to action and given that action meaning. There was a collective understanding of the purpose of the university. This sense of identity and purpose also appears in the present mission statement. Nebraska Wesleyan University is an academic community dedicated to intellectual and personal growth within the context of a liberal arts education and in the environment of Christian concerns. Now, let's look at the contemporary scene in higher education. In little more than a year, 5 major reports have appeared, each very critical of the various aspects of an undergraduate education. All the reports focused on the erosion of the quality of the baccalaureate degree. Factors deemed symptomatic of these erosions, falling test scores, declines in general education, high attrition rates, and inadequately prepared college graduates, all suggesting a crisis in higher education. The AAC report, Integrity in the College Curriculum, states, "The neglect of the real purposes and goals of education strikes at the very integrity of higher education." The most recent report, the Carnegie Foundation report on colleges, the undergraduate experience in America, like the others, also focuses on the confusion over goals. It states, "Scrambling for students and driven by marketplace demands, many undergraduate colleges have lost their sense of mission. They are confused about how to impart shared values on which the validity of both higher education and the society depend." And when we look at the church-related liberal arts college, that picture doesn't change. There is widespread agreement that the quality of undergraduate liberal education is not what it should be. It seems that that which once gave meaning to the enterprise has been dissipated. David Dill writes, and I like this because of your time, "In only 100 years, we have moved from colleges and universities with the symbols and traditions of required chapel, a liberal education heavily based on religious and moral precepts, and baccalaureate services at graduation to secular institutions which retain many of these symbols and rituals, but have discarded the underlying religious faith which gave these symbols meaning. In its place, we have adopted faith in disciplinary ideology. But at the very enterprise level, we have failed to develop a corresponding culture rich enough in symbol and ritual to provide a unifying sense of beliefs." In each report, after lamenting the current state of higher education, there is a vital appeal for the restoration of the liberal arts of general education. Each report points to the need for an integrated core, an approach to learning which provides an alternative to narrow professional training model proliferating the scene. Yet at the very time when there is a call for liberal learning, it seems that the majority of the small liberal arts colleges have committed themselves to a program that focuses on something else, on careerism or on discipline-based education. Now, I don't know if that is true for Nebraska Wesleyan, but that is what I generally witness as I visit institutions of higher education. I have recently had the opportunity to review the plans of a state university which is in the process of becoming the state's liberal arts college. And it is frightening to see what are perceived to be the basic ingredients of liberal education. All of the right phrases are there. The necessary division of distribution requirements, the emphasis on independent study, the commitment to scholarship, a student-centered curriculum, the use of extracurricular activities to enhance student development. However, the ingredient that is missing is the ethical dimension, the understanding that education is to create the good society, that human reason is to be used for the development of a humane community based on love and justice is not to be found. The great loss in the educational process today is an absence of the ethical dimension. We have permitted students to think that beliefs are less important than the facts. And the very core of liberal education is its concern for the good life. Bernie Merchlin wrote, "The role of education in its classical conception was first of all to train citizens to a sense of their own selfhood, and secondly, to train them to consider reflecting the ideals most likely to give meaning and direction to their communal existence." Our commitment to the disciplinary ideology, to careerism, has overshadowed any concern for a common set of beliefs that might give meaning to our actions. Leon Botstein, who is the president of Bard College, summarized this same idea when he wrote, "We have no vision of the good society, the good life, the ideal citizen and person. We would all rather hide behind liberal arts as mere techniques, as teaching how to reason, to appreciate, to write, to read, no matter the underlying judgments and opinions. To be liberally educated in this view is to possess only skills." That statement, although biting, depicts my own perception of liberal education in most liberal arts colleges. Too often the focus is on competence and not commitment. Educators have a responsibility to contribute to the moral development of their students and the society. And the assumption that moral sensitivity and humane conduct and concern for public welfare are automatic byproducts of education without direct involvement in the exercise of moral education has not proven itself to be true. This statement is not intended as an appeal for an indoctrination of an inflexible set of ethical judgments. The appeal is for a process of education that examines the various alternative systems of values and evaluates their human consequences. We must restore value considerations to the center of the intellectual effort. In addition, other aspects of liberal education need our consideration. We know that the content of liberal education has varied from century to century. The liberal arts curriculum is always changing, and today it is being challenged again. And I would like to try to envision what will take place in the near future. I believe that there are some overarching trends, drastic changes taking place in society that call for a genuine transformation in the liberal arts. I also believe that these trends are sharpening society's awareness of the mismatch between our educational programs and society's needs. We need to turn our attention to the emerging opportunities and redesign our educational programs to match the conditions of the coming decade. O Lord, spare me from intellectual arrogance, by which I mean the following. We are out of step. What are the forces that are driving or will drive educational change that call for transformation? The first is technology. Technology has become a dominant force in contemporary society. It affects our conception of ourselves and our reasoning and generates complex systems that affect the fundamental aspects of human existence. The educated citizen of the future and the present must be able to grasp and solve essentially technological questions intellectually and responsibly. As we move through the 80s, we are becoming more aware that there is a third culture, the culture of technology, vastly different from science and humanities. The natural or physical world and the social world have been joined by the artifact world, a world designed and constructed by human beings. And the ancient questions are still basic. What is truth, beauty, and justice? What is our relationship to nature, to each other, and to the cosmos? But the old answers simply won't do. We need a new liberal arts, one which takes cognizant of the new world brought into being by the growth of science and technology and their interaction with society. And technology is important not only because it designs and creates artifacts, but because I really believe it is a different way of knowing. That the methodology, that the mode of inquiry associated with technology differs from those that we have understood as the mode of inquiry of the sciences and the humanities. Unlike basic science, technology is action-oriented. It places a premium on intervention. It deals with uncertainty and ambiguity, and it focuses on decision-making, on defining what needs to be done, on finding a solution. Now, this alone justifies the appearance of the study of technology as a part of the basic curriculum of liberal education. But I think it also leads us to some interesting byproducts. Issues that tend to remain unsolved in the traditional liberal arts college often find new solutions when dealing with technology. One such issue has been the inability to introduce multidisciplinary studies effectively. And I think we have to own up to that. The study of technology presents a way to bridge the study of science and humanities. Technology in a unique way interrelates the scientific and human purposes. Technology invariably carries with it the questions of ethic. Technological change has political and social and psychological and economic implications. As a bridge between the two cultures, it demands a transdisciplinary approach, a true educational partnership between the sciences. And the introduction of technology has also the ability to bring a new sense of dealing with the how-to. And we have been less than excited about the how-to. Liberal education, as has been stated, deals with the why, dealing with discovering and understanding knowledge, but not its application. Technology springs from the arts and the crafts, yet uses its understanding of science to serve human needs. And, as has been suggested, the technologist how-to is the bridge between the scientist what is and the question of the humanities what ought to be. But more important, maybe from the student point of view, the introduction of technology in the liberal arts also prepares students for a career. Traditionally, the liberal arts college has tried to persuade its students with basic, tried to provide its students with basic knowledge as opposed to training for specific careers. And the expanding presence of technology in the workplace introduces the need for a new array of skills, which include quantitative reasoning, decision-making theory, and an understanding of how systems work. And there's a need to develop skills of this nature because they are both flexible and enduring. And these skills will be the critical skills needed as career paths erode and new paths emerge. The new liberal learning will come about when education in technology, with its distinct body of knowledge and method of inquiry, is woven into the liberal arts curriculum. And without this new dimension, students will be ill-prepared to deal responsibly with the world in which they live and with the major issues of the day. A second force that calls for transformation in higher education is our response to a pluralistic and interdependent world. We as a nation seem to be ill-prepared to today's swiftly changing, enormously complex, increasingly competitive world. We have finally become aware that we are not moving toward a single world culture. We have to accept the reality of a culturally pluralistic and interdependent world, and the vigor of our economy and probably the prospects for peace seem closely interwoven with the capacity of our understanding other nations and cultures. And the efforts of our colleges in teaching about other cultures and languages has been abysmal. I'm reminded of the statement of James Reston, who said that while America was all right in the hardware of high tech, in the software of languages, we were an underdeveloped nation. There seems to be little discussion of the role that education might play in helping to contribute to the global debate of the structures needed for a more just and equitable world, or the struggles that might be called for in achieving such a world. To prepare students to live in a pluralistic, interdependent world, we must help them to recognize the relativity of their own culture, to develop a capacity to live with others who are different, to think and feel globally, and to have the ability to analyze global issues and problems. Stephen Bailey, a number of years ago, suggested that we should turn out a generation of negotiators. That's another piece of ambiguity. If we are to achieve common purposes in the world, we must develop the skill of negotiation, the capacity to bargain, to discover areas of agreement. So often we talk about winning and losing, about right and wrong, when the true goal is to achieve the best possible outcome. And one of the most important tasks facing contemporary higher education may be negotiating a new world. And there's a third driving force for change, different in kind from the first two, and it might even be termed the demographic imperative. Much of our conversation about the decline of the 18-year-old has masked the two important trends. The first, the absolute increase in Black and Hispanic students who have been traditionally underrepresented in higher education. In 1984, the United States birth rate was the lowest in the decade, yet the birth rate for Hispanics was 86 births per 1,000 females. For the Blacks, it was 72, and for the whites, it was 64. In 1980, Hispanics numbered about 16 million, a 61% increase over 1970. Asians totaled 3.5 million in 1980, and now number 5 million, and most are immigrants to this country. Unless the education we provide responds to the needs of these students, the results will be an increasingly two-class culture that is unworkable socially and economically. And the fact is that when we have increased the number of black and Hispanic graduates from high school, we have decreased sharply the percentage who have gone on to college. The second demographic trend that will impact on education is the aging of the population. In 1983, we came to the first time that in this country there were more people 65 years of age and older than there were teenagers. In the Great Plains states, 20% of the population is over 65. Do you know what the most rapidly aging states are? Iowa, Kansas, and Missouri. And this, coupled with the changing structure of American industry, calls for an overall system of recurrent education. Lifelong learning is a necessity, not a luxury. And many workers will be displaced and will need new training to achieve another job, while others will need to be retrained to accommodate new technologies. Adult access to further education and retainment has become a national imperative. Somewhere along the line, I think we need to understand that we cannot expect to introduce our old products into new markets without adjustment. For too many of us, adult education has become the product of economic necessity and not a commitment. And adult education has been seen as an appendage. It's a kind of undergraduate education transferred to another age group. And we need to be sensitive to the needs of these different constituencies and sensitive to the needs of these persons for liberal education. There is a growing recognition that the world has changed unalterably and that education must also change. And to survive and flourish, education must respond effectively to the opportunities thrust upon it by a technological society, by a pluralistic, interdependent world, and by a shifting demography. Now, that should be enough of a challenge, but there's at least one more. Not only must there be a match between our educational programs and society's needs, but also we must indeed achieve what we claim we have achieved. Today's watchwords are assessment, accountability, and measurement. And it probably might be closer to true than we'd like, that the issue is that we're uncertain what students should learn, and we're not too sure as to whether or not they've learned it. I agree with Peter Yule, co-worker at NCHEMS, that to achieve excellence in the diverse activities currently comprising post-secondary education, we must create explicit institution-specific mechanisms for regularly assessing the degree to which we are in fact attaining our collective goal. Validating college outcomes means demonstrating that a liberal arts education assists students to meet the demands for later personal and professional performance. In order to plan our programs effectively, we need to be able to assess those outcomes. And if I were forced to say what is the one thing that is going to impact on higher education more than anything else, I would insist that it is this. I truly believe that within a decade, we will be held responsible to deal with the question of effectiveness, efficiency, the same way we're held responsible on a cost accounting basis right now. That the states, instead of asking only about cost effectiveness, they will be asking about academic effectiveness. And we need only to look at the state of Florida to see that process already in operation, where there is an exam that is given also in the private institutions in regard to the issue of the advancement of the student from the sophomore year to the junior year. Now, maybe you are spared on this one because it is a necessity because there's financial aid to the students who go to the private sector. Presently, we at NCHEMS are working with 10 liberal arts colleges to assess student outcomes. And the important part of the project is not the debate about measuring students' performance through testing, but the process of reviewing and stating the goals of the institution, of articulating a vision of the liberally educated person, and then devising a way to determine the degree of our success in that area. This process is most helpful in making the institutions become aware of their distinctiveness, their goals, their strengths, and their deficiencies. I sometimes think we've used the wrong term. We shouldn't be talking about student outcomes. We should be talking about institutional outcomes. And also focusing on the outcomes helps us identify curricular problems, to find what is broke so that we can fix it. We have come to realize that the critical elements that help to develop liberally educated persons must be understood, must be assessed, and addressed. If we look at the trends in the liberal education, what we are finding is that we are becoming terribly interested in the skills through the curriculum, but not the other pieces. I find it hard to understand how we stress writing through the curriculum, or in some cases mathematics through the curriculum, but that we don't want to stress values through the curriculum, or global awareness through the curriculum, or problem solving through the curriculum, or technology through the curriculum. The traditional pattern is we're interested in global awareness. Who is going to teach that course? A genuine commitment from the total community will be needed to incorporate these concepts. Another problem that has been a problem for higher education is that the same person who instructs a student also tests the student and also certifies that the student has learned the subject. And we must be more concerned that college graduates actually have the abilities that we claim. And there are a number of ways to separate instruction and achievement. Senior comprehensives with a panel of examiners, preferably some from the outside. Comprehensive examinations for general education courses. Comprehensive papers read by a panel. The critical issue, however, is not how many and what kinds of tests, or even what ways in which we engage in the process of certifying, but the attitude, the willingness on the part of all of us to commit ourselves to making sure that students achieve and maintain the capabilities that we think are commensurate with the degree that we award and that the vision we have of the educated person. Church-related liberal arts colleges singly and collectively face an identity crisis. And the questions this crisis provokes loom large. Who are we? Where should we be going? What changes do we need to make? What is our purpose? And I hope I gave you some indication of the approaches I would recommend in dealing with these questions. And Nebraska Wesleyan's long-range plan and the mission of statement and the general education requirements set forth in the catalog seem to indicate that the university is concerned with responding to these questions. And I hope that you will continue to assess the university's goals and programs so that you can continue to be what Berger calls the mediating structure. The mediating structures are the only organizations which can pull together the moral fabric of society because they have a value-generating and a value-maintaining function in that society. We need to be reminded that education is wisdom, requires a transmission of values as well as knowledge, and conscience as well as competence. Thank you.
Today, University Forum has presented Dr. Robert Lisinski, president of a Boulder, Colorado firm which provides consulting and instructional services to colleges and universities. His topic was liberal education, reform or renewal. This has been University Forum, a presentation of Nebraska Wesleyan University.